from 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Build. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Kids. Let's say you're a typical American kid, and you're thinking, like most kids do, about what you're going to be when you grow up. Football player, movie star, dancer. Those are all careers that we can see kids striving for at early ages. In fact, for some kids in America, practicing hard on the field or on the stage might seem like the only way to get out of a rough neighborhood or a tight financial situation. And yet, the job market for NFL quarterbacks or for Hollywood talent is still really, really tight. So what if we started to look at software development and database programming the same way we look at blocking and tackling? What if kids who learn to code today could be guaranteed six-figure jobs in just a few years instead of competing for a one-in-a-million chance at a career on the gridiron? That's just one of the questions we'll consider today with help from Sylvester Mobley. He's a veteran with experience in multiple branches of the armed forces, and he's taking a new approach to learning how to code into rec centers and classrooms. What he's discovering in the process could even impact the lives of adults who need to learn new job skills. It's the story of Coded by Kids, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
It's The Build. I'm Joe Taylor Jr., joined today by Sylvester Mobley. Welcome.
Thank you.
You are the founder of two organizations with kind of collaborative overlapping goals to a degree. Coded by Kids, Coded by You. We love to collect origin stories here on the show. So tell me a little bit about how Coded by Kids came into being.
So Coded by Kids started out as me teaching web development to one kid at a rec center on Saturday mornings. You know, for me, I got to start in tech when I went into the Air Force Reserves. Up until that point, I didn't know anything about tech. I had no idea, you know, what opportunities were available in the industry, you know, what the industry was like. I ended up falling essentially into the job. The job I picked in the Air Force, I had no idea what the job was.
And you came into the Air Force Reserves after having been in the Marine Corps.
So the military has this thing a lot of people don't realize, that you can reenlist, but you don't have to reenlist in the same branch. And essentially you're called prior service. So after 4 years in the Marine Corps, I then went into the Air Force Reserves. And then after 4 years in the Air Force Reserves, I went to the Army National Guard. So I spent a total of 12 years in the military in three branches. If you think about it, the average person, you know, in America, less than 1% of American society serves in the military, but I've served in three branches of the military.
Now, that's highly unusual, even by the standards of entrepreneurs that we talk to go from branch to branch. What's it like to transition out of one branch of service into another like that?
So I think going from the Marine Corps to the Air Force is probably the biggest transition. As a Marine, you are a Marine. I mean, that's how you define yourself. Marines can be extremely fanatical in the way they carry about everything, you know, the way you go about everything from day to day. The Air Force is a lot more laid back. You know, I can remember at one point my chief master sergeant in the Air Force pulled me aside and said, look, you're not in the Marines anymore. You need to calm down. We don't do things like that here. So going from, you know, that transition was a big transition. Also, the Air Force puts a really high priority on education, which, you know, in the Marines, they would always say you're a Marine first. That's it. You know, if you want to take some classes or whatever, you're a Marine first. You figure out how to work it in with being a Marine first. The Air Force, if there's something I wanted to do that was in line with what my job was, they always found a way to, you know, make sure I had the training or the education. You know, I learned about hardware. I learned about networking. I learned about fiber optic. So, you know, having that support and that experience to really learn about the technical field was huge for me. And then going from the Air Force to the Army, it wasn't as big of a transition. And by that point, I had already been in 8 years. So, you know, after 8 years in the military, it's just, it all just starts to blend together.
So you've done this grand tour of service. You've gotten into the cultures of different branches of the armed forces, and then you segue back into civilian life.
So while I was in the Army National Guard, you know, I was doing my 1 weekend a month duty and still working a civilian job. So I was working as a project manager. I was actually not working in tech in my civilian job at that point. I was essentially, what I said to myself was, when I was doing tech in the reserves, I didn't want to do the same thing I was doing in the reserves in my civilian job. I wanted to kind of have a broad range of what I was doing. So I was working in construction project management, my civilian job, but working in tech in my job in the reserves. I had went to Temple, ended up earning a degree in finance. So I was happy managing construction projects. I worked for a company that specialized in prisons. So I was building prisons essentially all over the country. I expanded, I think, 6 prisons for the state of Pennsylvania. I was building prisons as far out as Lubbock, Texas. It helped me because one thing I decided early on was I was never going to live in something that I built. So it was interesting, but also depressing. It was depressing to see the amount of money that was going into the corrections industry, the amount of money that was going into building prisons. And then being able to look at the amount of money that was going into the education system, you know, it was really sad to see the disparity. You know, even if you take right now, there's a $400 million prison that's being built to replace Graterford in Pennsylvania, but we can't find funding for our schools. So, you know, when you think about that disparity, it's sad. It's depressing. So, you know, I was doing that. And while I was doing that, I ended up being pulled out of my civilian job to deploy to Iraq. When I came home from Iraq, you know, I kind of, you know, was trying to figure out what's next. You know, it's this odd thing where I came home from Iraq and I wasn't really sure whether I had changed and everyone else had stayed the same or everyone else had changed and I had stayed the same. So, you know, you're trying to figure out where your place is in the world, and you're trying to almost refine yourself. Going through something like that, it's easier to do that when you're on active duty. You know, that's what you do. That's it. But when you're in the reserves and you get pulled out of your civilian life and all of a sudden they're like, hey, you know, this is what you're going to do for the next 12 to 18 months. And you're going to do this every day. You come home from a place like Iraq and you're just not sure anymore, like where you stand, where you belong, you know, what you should or shouldn't be doing as far as just life, you know, what your path forward is. And I wanted to figure out what that path for me was. And I started to really figure out, you know, where do I want to be? I didn't want to be in construction anymore. So essentially I took the construction project management experience that I had, the tech experience that I had, and combined the two and went into tech project management, started managing tech projects.
And the skill sets are pretty transferable from construction to technology.
Right. Right. So, you know, having a really good background in tech that I was able to get from the military, and then having the experience, you know, a lot of times when I'm talking to people and people ask me the difference between managing a construction project and managing a tech project, you know, often I say it's easier to manage a tech project than a construction project. You know, in tech, delays are common. In construction, you know, you don't have that luxury of saying like, well, we can push the project back. You know, I always get interested this time of year when I'm looking at construction sites and I see the sense of urgency with getting a building capped before, you know, it gets too cold or, you know, before you start to get snow. There's a lot of luxuries that you have in tech that you don't have in construction. So it forces you to take a very disciplined approach to how you manage your projects. So I was able to take those same skills. And those skills they transferred right into tech. I mean, essentially managing a budget, managing people, you know, managing a schedule. It doesn't matter whether it's a building or whether, you know, you're building a system.
So as you segue back into the technology community, what did you start to observe about the talent development process, about folks that were coming onto your teams?
You know, one of the biggest things I started to realize were there were very few people who looked the way that I did. You know, I'm a African-American male, and by and large, I was always either one of two or one of three. And I was always either one of two or one of three with large companies. You know, these weren't small shops for the most part. You know, these were, you know, I was working for a large publicly traded company, And, you know, there were two other people who looked the way that I did on, you know, on the tech team. And when I started to really ask myself, why was there such a lack of diversity in tech? You know, what the issues were. I wanted to separate out race, sex, age, and I always say age because a lot of people forget that age in the tech industry can be just as big a discriminating factor as race and sex. I wanted to separate those things out and look for what the common thread was that would prevent someone from gaining access to the industry. And the one thing I landed on over and over was skills. You know, when I think about my background and what it was like for me being a product of the public school system, for me, tech education in school and computer science class was essentially learning to type and learning to open and close documents. I didn't learn anything that was substantial. I didn't learn anything that would prepare me for the tech industry. The teachers that I had didn't even know the tech industry themselves. So even if I was curious, even if I had questions, they wouldn't have been able to answer those questions for me. You know, the teachers who taught computer science in the schools that I went to, you know, they were an English teacher who ended up becoming a computer science teacher, a math teacher. You know, none of these people had any tech experience and none of them could go beyond teaching basic tech, you know, basic computer fundamental. If that's the foundation of your education, unless you major in, you know, computer science or tech related field in college, you have no skills to prepare for the industry. I wanted to find a way to solve that or to bridge that gap because even if you go to college, you know, for me, I went to college, but if you don't even understand what's available, if you don't even understand what the options are, then you're probably not going to major in computer science or, you know, software engineering or something like that. And if you hear a lot of the misconceptions, you know, people say all the time, like, well, you got to be good at math and you have to be good at this. And I'll say, you know, especially to parents that I talk to, and they'll say, well, you know, I don't know if it's right for him. He's not very good at math. Say, I'm terrible at math. I'm fine as a developer. Like, you know, I've never had a problem as a developer. Like, and I'm terrible at math. I mean, I have a degree in finance and I'm terrible at math. I mean, like, it's.
That's what the spreadsheets are for, right?
Right. Like, you know, like, you know, don't put too much weight in that. But, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions and it honestly steers people away from the field. So I wanted to have a way of taking kids as young as possible and one, introducing them to the tech industry, introducing them to the field, because the only reason I was able to get introduced to it was from going into the Air Force. And I only picked the job that I picked because the recruiter basically said, okay, your prior service, you've been in, you know, because I had been in the Marines before, I didn't have to go through Air Force basic training or anything like that. I just had to pick a job that my test scores qualified me for. And I just saw a bunch of guys sitting in an air conditioned office with nice chairs. They looked like they were eating three times a day. And after being in the Marine Corps, I was like, you know, I don't want to be outside in the cold anymore. I don't want to be wet. I don't want to be hungry. They look very comfortable. That's the job I want. Had no idea what the job was. And she told me what the job was. Like, I don't care, whatever. Like, I mean, the job was computer network and cryptographic switching systems. I don't know what it means.
That sounds fine.
Yeah, I don't care. Like, you know, they
and as it turns out, that's a pretty complex gig.
It is. And it really was. And it wasn't what I was expecting. But the only reason I was able to get into that was because of that job. The average kid who's graduating from public school isn't going to go into, you know, the military at all. So how do we expose these kids to this? And that's really what I was searching for. And that question, you know, I didn't really have an answer to it in the beginning. And, you know, even now, 2 years into it, I'm still figuring it out. But, you know, in the beginning, the answer to that question was, okay, well, I'm just going to start teaching web development to inner city kids at a rec center. You know, I'm going to just have a free class and kids can come in and I'll teach them.
So you start with class number one and student number one. What's the pitch? Who did you go to? Who did you, we often talk with entrepreneurs who say there's a point at which you realize you don't have to ask permission. You just start doing things. So did you just roll into a school and open up a laptop? How did it start?
Well, I went to the director of the recreation center and basically said, hey, I noticed you have a computer lab. Also noticed that the computer lab is not being used. I want to use it. You have no classes going on in the computer lab. There's no programming going on. How about I set up a class in the computer lab? And he was like, you know what? That sounds great. You know, the computer lab is sitting upstairs. It's locked most of the day. If you want to do a class there, you have something you want to do, I'm more than happy to support that. I then went to the schools in the area of the recreation center and, you know, basically said, hey, would you mind making an announcement to the parents and students that I'll be at the rec center teaching web development classes, and, you know, anyone who wants to come is welcome. And from that initial push, I was able to get that one kid. And after, you know, that one kid started to come, the same director of the recreation center came to me and said, hey, notice you only have one kid coming. It's okay if you don't want to come back. Like, you know, if you don't want to keep doing this, it's not a big deal. It's all right. I said, look, you know, whether it's one kid or 100 kids, I'll be here. I'll keep coming. I think that was more the Marine in me saying, like, hey, I've made a decision, so I'm going to stick to it. And I didn't really fully understand what that meant, you know, but I quickly learned as more and more kids started to come, and that one kid grew into 10 and to 20 and to 30 kids.
And that growth, did it happen organically? How did it go from 1 to 10 to 100?
It did happen. A lot of it was organic. We started to get a lot of kids from word of mouth. You know, a parent would tell another parent, a kid would tell another kid, a teacher would tell a parent. We started to build relationships with schools in the city, and organically, kids just started to come in the door. You know, for me, it seemed like it happened so fast, where it was, you know, one day we had 5 or 6 kids coming in, and then the next thing I knew, we had more kids than computers, and we were asking for donations for computers to deal with the overflow of kids. You know, I started out with one class on Saturday morning, and before I knew it, we needed to add a second class to accommodate the number of kids we were pulling in.
And how many classes do you run now?
So right now we're still running 2 classes. So mm-hmm. We're running a Saturday morning class and a Thursday evening class.
Okay. And so the classes are spread out throughout the week. Where do you start with kids that come in?
So all of our kids, regardless of age, and age-wise, we start at 5. All of our kids, regardless of age, start at the same point. And they essentially start with a basic introduction to HTML. A big thing for me is I don't like the idea of treating kids like they won't understand something or they can't get something. I found that from teaching both children and adults, children are often easier to teach than adults, and our kids get it. You know, in the beginning, the problem was essentially the adults. You know, we were holding our kids back because, you know, we would talk about a different technology or we would talk about a language and say, well, you know, that might be too hard, so we're not going to teach them that, or, you know, we'll wait for that. And then I realized, just give it to them. So all of our kids, regardless of age, start out with basic HTML. We then introduce CSS. And then once they get good with HTML and CSS, we bring in JavaScript. As they get good with HTML and CSS and JavaScript, we then introduce backend technologies. So we teach our kids Node.js and MongoDB for the backend.
As a person who runs an agency who hires people who have Node.js and Mongo together, I can look forward to a steady stream of folks coming from your program who are probably 17, 18, 19 in like 5 years.
And that's, I mean, that's one of the biggest things we're trying to build. In a lot of ways, and when I'm talking to people, I look at this like youth sports, and I've modeled a lot of what we do off of youth sports. And that's the same approach that I'm taking. You know, the stakes in technology are just as high as the stakes in sports. You know, if you think about the deals people are getting in the tech industry and you compare that to the deals that people are getting in sports, I mean, like, the stakes are pretty high.
I mean, the last Node Mongo developer that we placed for a client through our agency is earning $240,000 a year. You know, that's, and statistically, that's probably easier to attain than a kid that thinks they might be an NFL quarterback. Right.
And not probably. I mean, it's without a doubt easier, but, you know, a lot of people don't realize that you have a far better chance of achieving a level of success through technology than through entertainment or sports. And a lot of kids in the inner city, they're only seeing people achieving success through sports and entertainment. So they feel like, well, this is the path I have to take because the only people I see becoming successful are becoming successful from this. But if you show a kid and say, well, no, there's something else, you know, you can also become successful from technology as well. It changes the dynamic. It changes the perception. And for me, if you're teaching kids at 6, 7, 8 years old, these technologies, you know, we have 9 and 10 year old kids that are using the command line, You know, they understand variables, they understand functions. We had a thing in one of our classes. We had a situation where some of our computer science students, who are third and fourth year CS majors, who help us out in class, couldn't help two of our 10-year-old boys because what the boys were doing, they hadn't learned in college yet. So if you take, you know, these kids and you're giving them these skills at this age and you create a structure that they never have to leave, you know, they're able to progressively move throughout their growth and development through our programs. By the time they graduate high school, they're so much further ahead than their peers. You know, if you think about people who go to the NFL, you don't all of a sudden decide in college, well, you know, I want to play for a Division I school and I want to play for the NFL. You've been playing football from the time you're old enough to walk. So why aren't we doing the same thing with technology with our kids? Why aren't we saying, from the time that you're old enough to sit in this class, from the time that you're old enough to walk and talk, we're going to immerse you in this, you know, and we're going to do it in a fun way. You know, we're going to make it feel like it's not school. We're going to make it feel like it's something that you want to do. It's enjoyable. You're going to be happy doing it. And we're going to help you grow and develop, you know, as you move through your childhood. One of the things that we're building out now is a tech entrepreneurship curriculum for our kids. More and more, I've realized a lot of the conversations, especially with our teenagers, always turn to entrepreneurship. We're teaching them essentially how to build products. You know, everything we do is project-based. So our kids are picking projects and they're saying like, well, how would I make money off of this? You know, how do I find customers? How do I charge people for this? So you know, organically are having these conversations around monetization and traction, scalability. So, you know, I said, all right, if we're giving kids the skills that they need to build products, then we also need to give them the skills they need to build companies around these products. And, you know, for me, it's about pushing innovation with these kids out of the inner city. You know, historically, the inner city has not been that place where you've seen tech innovation coming from. But you have a huge, huge wealth of talent in the inner city. It's just not being developed. And if you develop that talent and you give, you know, these kids the tools, the resources, and you say, look, I'm going to give you a support system. I'm going to teach you how to start a startup by the time you're 12, 13 years old. You have kids graduating high school that have essentially gone through the same things that someone who goes through an accelerator has gone through. You have kids who have, you know, real tech skills as well as real business skills. You know, I think that it has the power of changing the dynamic in inner cities.
I like the comparison to youth sports because you would go through a youth sports program with lots of artifacts, you know, game reels, plays, trophies, newspaper write-ups. Kids going through this program come out with actual websites, services, and now businesses.
Right.
So what are some of the things that the kids have actually built? You know, are there things that we can see they're running?
So there are. One of the transitions we've been making is having all of our kids use GitHub from day one. With that, we're able to leverage GitHub pages so that our kids can publish the websites they're working on GitHub pages. For our front and back end work that the kids do, we're using Heroku to push our kids' projects to that so that they can show people what they're working on. And the projects they work on really runs really runs a broad spectrum. One of our young ladies, I think she's 8, 9 years old. She loved the movie Frozen. So she wanted to build a website about Frozen. And that's essentially, you know, what she did. She built a website that showed the characters that, you know, she really liked. One of our 12-year-old young men recently started building a website for Star Wars. You know, as we got closer to the Star Wars movie coming out, he wanted to build a website that would become like a fan website where you could go and find out information about, you know, the different vehicles, the different weapons, the different characters. A group of our high school kids at Freire Charter just finished building a after-school extracurricular activity portal where the teacher that manages extracurricular activities can now go online. This has already been deployed to the internet. They can go online. The teacher can enter extracurricular activities, and students that are interested in participating in extracurricular activities can now go to that website, see what's available, you know, see what they need to do to sign up, figure out the times, And, you know, they have all the information they need via the web now. And it can be managed through the online console that the kids built.
Now, this is the kind of service that large organizations would try to sell into K-12 for six figures or higher. And a kid built it.
Right, right. So, and you know, one of the biggest things, especially our teenagers, is getting them to function like a real software development team. So, you know, you have a group of ninth and 10th graders who have their own project managers. They have their own front-end developers, their own back-end developers, their own designers. And by the end of, you know, the fall session, these kids were functioning the way a software development team would function. And by the end of the fall session, I was able to step back and say, okay, now you guys have to manage yourself. You know what you need to do. You know what needs to be done. It's your project. I'm here if you have questions, but I'm going to sit back and, you know, I'm just going to watch. And they essentially did that. You know, the project manager, she would write on the board in every class, this is what we need to get done in this class. This is what, you know, is coming up for next class. This is how much time we have. She would check with everyone. Hey, you know, where are you? How long is it going to take you to do this? You know, it was funny. At one point, she came to me and said, you know, I think being a project manager is like being a stalker. I feel like I'm always stalking people.
It's not far off.
And I was like, exactly. I was like, you're exactly right. I mean, that's what it is. But, you know, for me to see a group of ninth and 10th grade kids who can function like a software development team and push a product out with, you know, with a little adult supervision, you know, it shows what they're capable of, you know, and I think it's amazing.
Well, I'm also envisioning the skill set coming into college. You know, part of my background was supervising a bunch of internship programs at Penn. And one of the biggest challenges we had was getting students as undergrads, first year, second year students who had no skills whatsoever organizing a project or collaborating with peers. And it was, this may have been the first time that they'd ever, you know, at an Ivy League institution in their first year, been on a team of five or six or seven, and no one knows who's in charge, right? But you've got folks coming out of this program by age 11, 12, 13, already knowing what the different kinds of roles and responsibilities are. So what's going on with our approach to education, especially in the public sector, where this is still considered something that is okay to be an extracurricular program, but we don't have it built into the curriculum at all?
I think one of the biggest problems I see, and, you know, usually when I talk about issues with education, I tend to bring a unique perspective because we run our own standalone programs where we function almost like our own school, but we also run programs in schools. So I spend a lot of time in schools. I'm also in a lot of what I do deeply involved with the tech industry at, you know, as a whole. So I spend a lot of my time talking to CTOs and CEOs. So I'm seeing both what teachers are doing and I'm seeing how much effort they're putting out. And a lot of times I think teachers, you know, we often point our finger at teachers and the schools and we're saying, no, you're not doing a good job. You know, the teachers are failing, the teachers are doing this. But I'm in schools running programs, you know, and day after day, I see teachers that are giving 120 and 130%. But I also see what the result is. You know, I see the kids who are coming out of high school and kids who are coming out of college. And I talk to the people who are running the companies who are saying, I'm not getting what I need. You know, I'm getting kids that can't think outside of the box. I'm getting kids that aren't creative thinkers. I'm getting kids that can't work independently. I think that there's one, a disconnect between the school system and industry. Schools are working in a silo and they're saying, we have a curriculum that we work with. You know, these are the measures and metrics we need to hit. We did what we were supposed to do, but the schools aren't looking at what that end result is. You know, if you look at a child almost like a product, the schools never look at what that product is when that kid goes into the workforce. You know, the schools never take a step back and say, is this child that we've produced really able to contribute in the workforce the way they need to? The schools just say, hey, we produced this kid. They passed their tests. We did what we were supposed to do. And the biggest problem with that frame of thinking is our school system is still set up to send people to work in factories and farms. I mean, we're using a school system that was designed, you know, you're talking about 50, 60 years ago, where people were going to work in factories, and all they needed to do was prepare you to go to work in a factory. Our society has changed tremendously since that. And to say we can still use the same methodology in the same school system to prepare someone to go to work for a company where they're, even if they're not in technology, they're going to be immersed in technology. You know, the reality is there is no tech industry anymore. It doesn't matter what you do, you're involved in tech. You know, the question is just how much. So to use that same system and expect a good outcome is crazy. And, you know, for teachers, it doesn't matter whether you put forth 120, 130% if the system that you're using itself is flawed. And I think that's a big part of the problem. The system is flawed, but no one really wants to look at, you know, how do we change the system itself?
So one of the effects of that, or one of the ripples, is when we speak with CTOs, a lot of what we hear is we can't find talent. We're struggling to source candidates that understand how to work in a team, how to work with this kind of technology. I heard you give voice to the idea that technology needs and programs often change faster than schools can even build curricula around them. So tell me a little bit about the new venture that you're opening up, Coded by You, which is an opportunity to address some of those shortfalls with students who are adult learners.
So Coded by You essentially was born out of Coded by Kids. We wanted to start doing programs for adults for a couple of different reasons. One, looking at some of the households and communities our kids were coming from, I had to ask myself, are we really taking a holistic approach to our kids if they're coming from homes where, you know, they have a single parent who can't put food on the table or can't keep the lights on? We're running all these great programs for the kids, you know, but they're still going home and, you know, they're not eating dinner, or, you know, their electricity is getting cut off. And I wanted to make sure that we were taking a holistic approach to the communities that we serve. So I wanted to start running programs for adults. And I quickly found that adults didn't want to come to a program called Coded by Kids. So we started to brand our adult programs as Coded by You. Coded by You really started out as a way of giving low-income adults access to high-quality programming-focused and software development-focused education classes and education programs, and, you know, do it at, you know, a fraction of the cost that they would have to pay for a traditional dev bootcamp, and give them more flexibility than they would have at a traditional dev bootcamp. You know, when you think about the cost associated with a traditional development bootcamp, it prices out the people who would need the training the most. You know, the people who are low income, the people who are struggling to get by and struggling to find a career path, they can't pay, you know, what these programs are asking for.
I think too, the other issue is, it's about time too. Right. It's about fine. So for folks listening that don't know the format or structure of a development bootcamp, typical development bootcamp takes how long and costs how much?
So typically, you know, you're talking about 8 to 12 weeks, and, you know, for these 12 week, you know, a lot of them are either full time or part time, where you're in class 4 to 8 hours a day, 4 to 5 days a week, and you're talking about $10,000 to $15,000 out of pocket that you're spending. So to say to someone, not just I'm going to expect you to spend $10,000 to $15,000 out of pocket for this program, even, you know, some programs have tried to be more flexible with payment, where they've said, well, you know, we can do a payment plan, or, you know, we'll take a certain percentage out of your paychecks when you find a job. You're still saying to someone who's struggling to keep their lights on, you need to do this at a minimum part-time program where 4 to 5 days a week you're in class, you know, at least 4 hours a day. This person is struggling, you know, often working 2 to 3 jobs just to sustain themselves. Now to say, hey, you're going to have to stop that to do this, it's unsustainable. It's just not something that they're able to do.
And so the idea by Coded by You, and what I love, again, because we're on the radio, this is, it almost sounds like Coded by University in a
right,
way,
right.
Coded by the letter U. The approach here is to spread out the time commitment a little bit, and then you've got different options for how people can enroll and pay for this course. In some cases, maybe not even at all.
Right. So, you know, we'll as we start to adjust our pricing to be more competitively priced as far as the market, we're still maintaining, you know, the slots for our original target market, which was low to middle income adults. And essentially we're rolling out, we're calling it the Coded by You Fellows program, where everyone who's in the Coded by You Fellows program receives a scholarship to the programs. We also, you know, we have it set up so that it's one day a week that you actually have to come in class, and that one day in class is in the evenings. Everything else, you know, we're working virtually, you know, we're doing Google Hangouts, you know, we're communicating via Slack and via email. That gives our students a lot more flexibility as far as, you know, when do I need to be in class? When do I need to be in class? How do I get the work done? It does require that our students function more independently.
But I think that mirrors a lot of the work environments that I see developers going into these days. I see more folks spending time on Slack than together in a room.
It does. It does. And a big thing for us too is, you know, we do want to push a lot on our students. I want to make sure that we're not just doing something that benefits our students, but also benefits the companies that they're going to go to work for. And I don't want anyone to come out of Coded by You and then their employer say, hey, this person just can't do the job, or, you know, this person can't work independently, or, you know, can't work on a team. We want the people who are coming out of our programs to be able to go to work and add value. You know, this is it's a two-way street. You know, we want to give an opportunity to our students, but we also want to contribute and add value to the companies that they're going to become a part of.
And you're getting input into the curriculum from some potential employers as well.
Right. So, you know, Coded by You is taking the same approach as Coded by Kids. And Coded by Kids, in a lot of ways, has been a product of the tech community. You know, from the very beginning, I was asking developers in the tech community, hey, what should we be teaching? And, you know, these are still conversations we're having every so often. You know, as technologies are changing, as new things are coming out, you know, we're constantly having conversations about, hey, what do our kids need to know? What should we be teaching? What shouldn't we be teaching? And Coded by You is no different. We can't say we're going to pick, you know, I can't say I'm going to pick and decide on my own what I think we should teach. And I'm going to say to companies, you should hire these people, even though I made the decision. You know, I want companies to be involved. For me, this is a collaborative process. You know, hey, let's come together and decide, what do we need as a whole? You know, what does the industry need? What can we teach? You know, what's feasible in a 12-week program? What's feasible, you know, in 10 weeks or 8 weeks? And, you know, let's come to that middle ground so that we're running a high quality program that's giving people the skills that they need to be successful, but we're also giving them the skills they need to add value to the industry.
So a typical large organization staffs up a big HR enterprise, automated screening tools, looking at where was your four-year degree from? Did you get a master's on top of that? How do your candidates end up getting into a recruiter's pipeline?
So through a lot of the partnerships we've been making with the companies that we partner with, the companies directly that we work with, and essentially, you know, a lot of it is me saying, all right, what are you going to be looking for within the next, you know, 6 to 12 months? And let's talk about how we could meet that need. Let's talk about how we could produce those developers that you need to fill those spots. We've also gone into a partnership with a tech recruiting firm, Agile Hires. And through Agile Hires, they're also working with clients saying, okay, you need 2 or 3 developers, and, you know, Coded by You can provide those 2 to 3 developers. Let's figure out what skills they need to have. In a lot of ways, we also have a little more flexibility because of the way we structure the time and the way we work with our students. We're able to say to a company, okay, we're not just going to train somebody and dump the person on you. This is a partnership between you and us. So you tell us, what does the person need to be able to do when they walk in the door on day one? And that's what we're going to focus on. When they walk in the door on day one, you're also going to tell us, hey, this is what the person's doing really good on. This is what the person's weak on. And because we essentially don't go away, you know, Coded by Kids and Coded by You, they're more communities than anything else. Our students are coming back. You know, we had an issue with one of our teenage students who was working as a front-end developer. And his employer said, hey, you know, he's really good. He's doing great work. He just needs a little work on version control. I said, oh, that's simple. You know, he'll be in class on Thursday. So when he comes in class on Thursday, we'll focus that class with him on version control. And that kid was able to go back to work the following week, and he had version control down.
I wish version control was the biggest issue I had had as a teenager.
So, I mean, it's funny working with teenagers, you know, especially this kid. I was like, you know, you're 16, you're working as a front-end developer. Like, you know, are you excited? He's like, nah, it's cool.
Oh, it's cool. Yeah. When I was 16, I was sweeping up popcorn at a movie theater.
Right. Yeah.
So how do you see, I mean, you're growing this community of alumni. Folks are actually getting jobs out in the community. How do you see this thing scaling? How does it grow over time? What's your dream for this organization?
So Coded by You is going to essentially take on all of our revenue for profit, our ventures that we've been doing. So we work with schools, and, you know, essentially schools will pay us to design and run a programming class for them. So, you know, we'll run coding classes based on the needs of the school. With our adult programs, you know, adults are paying for those classes. We now have an internal development shop as well. We started the internal development shop initially as a way of being able to do work for small businesses and nonprofits that had missions that we believed in, but didn't have the budgets for a large development shop. And it gave us the opportunity to give our students real world experience, where a lot of times employers are saying, like, well, you know, it's great that they did this course, but they need to have work experience. With our internal dev shop, our students get work experience. You know, they're working on real paid projects. And we also have the ability to now say, hey, look, I can pay you to learn. You know, you're going to work on this real project, so you're able to continue your learning and, you know, continue developing, but you're also getting paid to continue your learning.
And this is not unlike the kind of models I see at business schools, where there are think tanks, there are paid, you know, you can have undergrad research students and master's folks working on projects for companies. It becomes part of that team's portfolio over time.
Right. And, you know, that student is able to go out into the world, you know, and say, hey, I've done real things. You know, this is the experience I've had. You know, it also gives it gives us the luxury of time, where we're not hindered by the constraint of saying, we have to place this person in a job today. You know, we're able to say, hey, look, you know, why don't you keep learning this? Or why don't you work on this technology? We have a project for you. You know, we'll pay you to work on the project. We'll keep learning. And then if you know, once you finish, you know, let's look for a job. You'll be in a better position to find the job that you really want at that point.
And maybe it's the hallmark of a program designed by a project manager, but I see it iterating over time. But this is also bootstrapped. This is not and for the Philly nonprofit community, it's probably heresy to talk about something that grew organically this way and didn't start with an $8 million foundation grant from somebody. But you've just grown this step by step, one iteration after the next.
Right. So, and that's one of the things that kind of separates us from a lot of nonprofits in the city. And when we have, you know, often when I'm having conversations with other executive directors of nonprofits, you start to see those differences, where a lot of nonprofits, their path is, we're going to get funding from a foundation, we're going to get funding from a grant. We're going to do our 501c3 process, and we're going to sustain ourselves through grant funding and foundations. Coded by Kids started out as me saying, okay, I'm going to fund the organization, build a good quality program, and then, you know, build a business model around that so that we're self-sustainable as a nonprofit. And if a foundation wants to give us money and our goals are aligned, then we'll take that money. But we need to be able to sustain ourselves. So by having the business model where we're running programs for schools, we're also doing workforce development, where we're partnering with larger nonprofit organizations and essentially saying, okay, you traditionally do workforce development, but you're training people to paint houses, or you're training people to work in kitchens. We can plug in our program and become your tech-focused workforce development provider. And, you know, this is how much it costs for us to do that. Having that business model, it gives us the luxury of saying, we don't have to apply for grants. We don't have to take foundation money. It's nice. You know, it's always welcome, but, you know, we can do it on our terms.
And then the structure of the organization is really kind of two pillars. One, Coded by Kids, that's nonprofit purely. Coded by You is actually a for-profit organization, but you know, whatever profits, whatever you throw off, you spin off goes to fund.
Right.
Coded by, and that's where you're not having to go through the typical nonprofit registration. Your accountant cries at night and rocks sobbing in the corner.
So we try to keep things as simple, accounting wise as possible, but having Coded by You as the for profit, you know, we're able to essentially run a business and say, hey, you know, the connection between the two organizations is really the commitment that Coded by You is making financially to Coded by Kids. It's more complicated than a lot of people would want, but you know, on the other hand, there's a lot of advantages that it gives us that we like. It gives us the ability to both go after grant funding and foundation money through Coded by Kids, but also look for impact investing and, you know, people who are, you know, angel investors who are willing to invest in a social venture through Coded by You. So, you know, when we have two avenues of raising funding, and it gives us flexibility in how we operate.
Well, it seems like it also gives you the freedom that you're not beholden to a single stakeholder either. Right. You can go out and find the support wherever it comes from, whether that's doing a for-profit project for a business client in the dev shop, or it's actually going through a traditional foundation, you know, and getting a grant to, you know, expand or scale. And in terms of scalability, where are the instructors coming from? I mean, you won't be able to be teaching every single class yourself for long.
So we've been pushing to develop instructors internally. So if you look at our actual paid instructors on the for-profit side, they've come from within Coded by Kids or Coded by You. Essentially, as someone is going through the Coded by You programs, I'm identifying people who I think have the personality, the temperament, you know, the character to go into the classroom. One thing, you know, that's being a good developer is completely different from being a good teacher. And I've seen a lot of great developers who, once you put them in a classroom, it all falls apart. So for me, it's not just about producing good developers when we're looking at teachers, but also producing people who have that personality to go into a classroom. So as we have people going through our programs, I'm always identifying people who I'm saying, hey, you would be really good if you were teaching this. And these are the people that we've been hiring and bringing on as our instructors. You know, we're also looking to expand how we do that and be a little more deliberate with working with programs that train teachers, working with programs that are doing alternative teaching certification programs, and essentially saying like, hey, you know, do you have people who want to teach technology? You know, we have a program where we can teach them the teaching technology portion. You can prepare them to get their teaching certification. And, you know, now we have that constant sustainable pool of instructors. Sustainability and scalability are two huge things for us. And over the last, I would say, 9 to 12 months, we've been doing a lot of work on really looking at how we operate, looking at what we do, what we need to do, how do we make it scalable, pushing with really nailing down a good process for onboarding schools and rolling out to schools, you know, getting it to the point where we can rapidly onboard a school as a client, whether that school is in Philadelphia or California, you know, roll out a high quality program, roll out a high quality class, adjusting our pricing model to allow us to be scalable. I mean, sometimes your pricing model itself can prevent scalability. So looking at how do we price? How do we charge? How do we train our teachers? How do we train our instructors? You know, we've had to develop our own teaching training program to train developers to be teachers, because one of the things I realized was, you know, it's hard to be a teacher. And, you know, just in line with some things I previously said, you have to equip someone to go into the classroom, especially if you want to be able to scale what you're doing. You know, we needed a way of rapidly onboarding people and saying, okay, you're a great developer. Now we're going to teach you how to take your development skills and take those into a classroom to teach people how to do it themselves.
What's the biggest competency? What's the biggest skill that someone has to take on to be effective as both a developer and a teacher?
Patience. We're fortunate enough to, especially with our volunteer instructors, we're fortunate enough to get volunteers who come from a lot of the major development shops and companies throughout the city. We get developers from Xavier. We get software engineers from Comcast. We have developers from, you know, the Office of Innovation and Technology of the City of Philadelphia. And we get people who have 10 to 15 years of software engineering and development experience. They're great developers. But once you stick them in a room with a bunch of 7, 8, 9-year-olds and say, look, you know, I want you to teach this kid how variables and functions work, you see quickly that it falls apart for some people. And, you know, I've had people come to me, and these were, you know, highly experienced developers, and say, well, he's just not doing it. Well, he's 6 years old. You know, he's not going to just do it. You know, you gotta be creative. You know, you gotta figure out how to, you know, get him to do it without him realizing he's doing what you want him to do. You know, so that patience to really work through problems with, you know, with a student is, you know, the biggest thing that I find. And, you know, really having empathy. You know, sometimes we get really good at something and we forget what it felt like to not be really good at that thing. You know, if we've been doing something 10 or 15 years, our short-term memory is just of us being good at it. You know, we don't remember 11 years, you know, before that, or 16 years before that, where we were just trying to figure it out or just learning. And having the empathy, you know, being able to put yourself in your students' shoes and say, you know, I remember what it felt like for this to be difficult, or for this to be complicated. And how did I feel when I was at this point? And what helped me to get past that point is huge. It helps a lot.
So how do students, prospective students, get involved in any of your programs?
Usually by reaching out to us. Our students, both children and adults, can register online. So they can go online and, you know, register. For the adults, it's a little different because, you know, there's a little more of an onboarding process that they have to go through, and they have to wait to make sure that there's a start date that's coming up. For the kids, you know, once the kids have registered, their parents complete all the registration information. It's just a matter of them bringing them to class. And then, you know, they start their first class.
And you have classes that start throughout the year?
For our kids, we run every week unless it's a major holiday. So we don't do workshops or sessions. It's just it's structured more like a boys and girls club where we're there every week unless it's a holiday.
So there's no, it's not like, you know, YMCA basketball. You can just pick up and start whenever.
Yeah. You can, for our kids, they can pick up and start whenever they want.
Great. Excellent. And the website address for folks who want to get involved.
So the website for Coded by Kids is codedbykids.com. And the website for Coded by You is codedbyu.com.
.coms. Again, not even a .org for that.
Not even a .org.
Now I'm going to take this over to our nonprofit podcast, and my co-host will have so many thoughts.
Right.
All right. Sylvester Mobley, founder of Coded by Kids, Coded by You, thanks so much for stopping by The Build.
No problem. Thank you.
The Build is a production of 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Our producer is Lori Taylor. Our associate producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our talent coordinators are Katrina Smith and Gazem Yali. And our post-production team is led by Evan Wilder at Flowly Audio in Detroit. My name is Joe Taylor Jr. Thanks for listening to The Build.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 Radio production.